Okay, first of all, always feel judged. Is my voice like my brother's voice? First of all, it is a wonderful opportunity to be able to spend some time with you tonight and to be able to learn with you. I don't have the opportunity to come by here so often, but when I do, I very much enjoy. And I can say, being very friendly and family with some of your teachers, they definitely speak with a great sense of pride at the opportunity they have to spend their days with you and to teach you, and something which is really, I'm sure, very, very special. I wanted to talk tonight about a topic, one that is, sorry, Pat, there's no clock in the room? That's intentional, but just, yeah, is there, yeah, okay.
Can you remind me to return it afterwards?
Well, my wife came on the lunch. I want to talk tonight about a topic that is a very important one in the world of machshava, in the world of Jewish thought. It is one that I think has a lot of implications in the world of hashkafa, in terms of how one approaches a variety of issues. And I think it's one that, if we do it correctly, hopefully can have some practical implications in terms of the way that we relate to a variety of different things. Let me start as follows. Rav Kook, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Kook, if you look in many Batei Medrash, if you look here as an example, so you have a set of white svarim. Rav Kook did not publish a lot of those svarim. He didn't write them to be published. He was always writing. He was a person that had journals with him, and whenever he happened to be inspired, he was feeling it. So Rav Kook would sit down a little bit and he would write. And his students, or his son and some of his other students, would take different sections from the journals, and they would put them out and publish them as books. So those svarim were not originally published or written by Rav Kook as svarim, but they were sort of collections. One of those works of Rav Kook, which is very beautiful and very unique, is his commentary on the Siddur. And Rav Kook has a very well-known insight, and one that I hope can frame a little bit some of what we speak about. It's from Rav Kook's Parish on the Yom Kippur davening. And in the middle of the Vidoy, we have a line, Elokai ad shlo notzarti eini kedai, v'achshav shenotzarti ki lo notzarti, that we mention in the Vidoy a very strange formulation, not one that's going to really pick us up at all. God, until you created me, I was not worthy, and now that you did create me, it's as if you didn't create me. It's a very sort of statement that's not particularly uplifting or inspiring. And Rav Kook understands that built into this line is a very profound truth, one that I think, as far as at least the way I understand it, is exceptionally important. Rav Kook writes that every soul that is created is only brought down to this world at that moment in the era that soul is meant to be there. Meaning that my soul was sitting up there in Shemayim and God was waiting. Ad shelo notzarti eini kedai. Until I was actually created, it was not yet that time in this world where I was meant to be brought down. I'm waiting for that era when I'm able to do that which I'm meant to be able to do. And Rav Kook therefore understands that when we are created, we're created for this era. We're created for this time period. This is when we have the opportunity, says Rav Kook, to fix and to accomplish and to contribute. Not 200 years, this era, 2060, this is when I have the opportunity to do whatever it is that I'm supposed to do. And if you're a believer in the idea of Rav Kook, so there are two things I believe that one wants to do. Number one is to understand a little bit, and for this, we'll have a bit of a broader conversation, a broader discussion, what it means that there are different generations, the relationship between our generation and previous generations, and two is to be able to understand a little bit some unique insights, hopefully, about contemporary times, about this particular era, and why it's significant and why it matters. I was speaking with my brother earlier in the week about, I emailed him a list of potential topics, and I was a little bit nervous because Elul time, people speak about Tshuva a lot. I remember I had a student last year in the yeshiva who told me that in his Shana Aleph, so he thought for the first from through Yom Kippur, that all they speak about in yeshiva the whole year is just tshuva, And he thought that was like a little bit much for him, but he was like debating, can I handle it, can I not handle it? And sometimes we speak about that a lot. So I don't want to speak that much about tshuva, but at the end, we'll just a couple brief insights, hopefully, that can be important. So let's start. You read this Hadoros. Chazal have a line in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos. It's a line which is thought-provoking, and for many of us, at least for me, naturally, intuitively, I don't know if I would agree with. Amr b'zeir, amr rabar bar zimona, rishonim b'nei malachim, anachnu b'nei anashim. If the earlier generation, says the Gemara, were like angels, anachnu b'nei anashim, so we're like people. V'im rishonim b'nei anashim, and if they were like people, so anu kichamorim, so we're like donkeys. V'lo kichamoro shar b'chanina ben dosa, b'shar b'nei p'nechas ben yair, ela kishar chamorim. The Gemara here seems to teach us a very powerful statement and somewhat of a depressing one. The Gemara seems to describe a reality in which every generation is lower than the previous one, and that those shifts are significant. So if they're like angels, we're like people, and if they're like people, we're like donkeys, but says the Gemara, not like the holy donkeys, not like a Pinchas ben Yair's donkey. We're like the regular donkeys. And that seems to be somewhat of a depressing opening. And if you look in terms of, in what way is that true? Are we less intelligent? In what way are we considered to be lower? How does that manifest? In what way? So if you look in the Rishonim, you find some interesting things. Again, some of them may be not so uplifting. Rashi writes in source number 3, Lefisha Doros Hayu Tovim Vitzadikim in Ha'achorim. You know what the drop is, says Rashi? It's the drop in regards to piety. They used to be big tzaddikim, and now that's not what we see. Now we're less righteous. I feel that every time, and I feel very close to my grandmother. My grandmother is a very holy woman. Whenever I go to America to recruiting season for the boys, I always schedule my trip so that I'm in Silver Spring on a Monday, so I can drive down from New York and stop at her house in Lakewood on the way. And whenever I It's a highlight of my trip to be able to spend a couple hours with my grandmother. And my grandmother is an incredibly righteous woman. And whenever we just talk with her, help her run some errands, and just spend the afternoon together, I'm always struck by this Rashi a little bit. There is sometimes that there are people a generation or two above that we interact with that are just incredibly righteous. There's something holy about them. Rashi understands that's true not just with individuals, but as a whole, the generation is falling. The Chovas Halavavos, Reinu Bachya, the Chovas Halavavos writes that it's a drop as far as intellect. They used to be really sharp. They used to be really intelligent. And we're just sort of dropping. Anyone disagree with that? If you're comfortable disagreeing with a rabbi named Rabbi Nebachia, anyone that's comfortable disagreeing with that? Yeah, what's your name? Nice to meet you, Hooper. Yeah. Can you share with you? Sorry, I just made that awkward. Can you, what do you disagree about that? What about that do you disagree with? We have a lot more access to information. If you look in terms of the progress that I think we maybe made as far as technology and the like, there are a lot of phones on the table outside. Not as many as people in the room, but there are a lot of phones on the table outside. And as, you know, that's definitely a sign, I would think, of a certain kind of intellectual progress. Rashi and Bereshis write another difference. Another difference. Rashi and Bereshis write that with each generation, there's actually, we become weaker. Earlier generations, if you read Chumash, the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, the description are people that lived hundreds of years. Hundreds of years. And in our generation, and as time goes on, says Rashi, people start living for less and less time. Anyone argue with that, Rashi? Yeah. What do you argue? What's problematic about that, Rashi?
That we live longer nowadays.
We live longer nowadays. We live longer nowadays. Okay, interesting also. If you look at some of these sources, and I'm trying to understand what you read as Hadoros is, I find Mikoros, I find sources that tell me there are a lot of significant differences between people who are, it sounds like it's depressing, you would never want to sit, we're less, it's less intelligent, less righteous, weaker. I don't know of a realm we could think of where you're not getting this impression from some of these sources that there's a significant drop. Some of this doesn't fit with what many of us intuitively feel. Or if we look around at the world and ponder where we're at relative to previous generations, I think for many of us, we probably don't stop and think and say, we're lower. We probably look around and we say, things are getting better. It's more convenient. It's something which is that the world's progressing in powerful ways. But when you start looking at some of the sources in the Gemara here or there, we get the impression sometimes that there's a different story that Chazal are indicating. And there are some who maintain, there's a well-known professor in Haifa, Professor Menachem Kellner. Anyone ever hear of him? I take back the well-known part of the introduction. In certain circles, I guess. I don't even know which circles. I guess the academic Jewish studies people. Professor Menachem Kellner wrote a book where he maintains that the Rambam rejects the whole concept of Yiritas HaDoros. Rambam doesn't buy it. He doesn't buy it. If you look at some Rambams in Hilchos Mamrim in source number 6, the Rambam seems to think that it's not really as true as we would think. That earlier generations can be argued upon by later generations, and even if, it's like in the world of Gemara, one of the earliest rules that people are taught when they start learning Gemara is that an Amora can't argue on a Tana. There are those who suggest, or Chaim Salvechik thought, it's not because the Amora is lower. It's because the Amoram decided upon themselves not to argue with Tanaim. But really they could. And that's a Rambam kind of an idea, argues Professor Kellner, that maybe there isn't as much of a drop as we would think. Okay. Not everyone buys that. If you look in certain Svarim, what you find is a kind of idea that I think probably resonates a little bit more and probably describes more the reality that we're used to. So far, we've tried to point out is that according to Rav Kook, we're born to a specific era. And to understand this era, so step one would be, if I'm a real, that Gemara and Masechta Shabbos, sometimes we showed him. So if I'm a Rav Kook person, I'm thinking, so I'm born into this era, and this is an era which is significantly less righteous, intelligent, and strong, and you walk away with the impression of that, I don't feel so great about that. And you shift a little bit, as we're going to right now, to a variety of sources that tell us, generations don't get worse, generations get better. Generations progress in a certain sense, and there are a couple of different ways of saying it. Some of the things I'm going to say are a little bit not mainstream, but we'll try to get the ball rolling a little bit just to understand a little bit some of these sources. There's a tshuva of the Tosfos Rid in source number 10. I apologize for the exceptionally small font. I don't remember why. When you want to get it on two pages and not a third, I guess sometimes you do things like that. So it seems. The Tosfos Rid offers, he quotes the philosophers who offer the following insight. It relates to what I believe Ahuva said before. And that is that generations do drop a little bit. Ahuva, I was right about the name, right? Would have been bad to mess up. The Gemara describes a mashal the philosophers gave that a giant, some of us are going to be familiar with this, a giant can see much farther than a dwarf, but the decline of generations, much generations may fall, dwarfs standing on the shoulders of giants are able to see much further. Argues the Tosfos Rid that even if there is a bit of a drop, we have access to all of which they did. And that's what positions us to be in a different place. And when I walk into this era, what this era has is a Beit Midrash that's filled with Svarim. It's a Beit Midrash that is filled. It offers us an opportunity to learn so many different things, to be able to benefit from it, and to pull information from different places. So it could be, if we use the example in the world of technology, so even if, maybe, if I'm a Tosfos Rid, I would say, we're not necessarily as gifted as some of the original inventors of, but building on what they did, we're able to do things that no one had ever done before. And there isn't as much of a drop, maybe, as we would think. Why does it matter, you reach the doors or not? I'll give you one hashkafic difference. Anyone went to SDR High School? Okay. Camp Morshat or Camp Misora? That's better representation. Rabbi Shmuel Hain, I think two summers ago was in Morshah and this summer was in Camp Misora. So he once, it's an amazing insight that I never thought of. If you are a, How many people in the room believe in Torah Umada, in the value of secular studies? If we were to ask, can you please mention for me a figure who was a good model of success in Torah Umada? Any names that could be thrown out? Salvechik's a great one. Any other names? The Rambam's a fantastic name. The Rambam's a great one because Salvechik is fantastic also. The Rambam's great because the Rambam's a Rishon, he's a person of enormous authority. And the Rambam's a person who clearly was able to derive an enormous amount from the world of Greek philosophy. He was able to write a book like Mor Nebuchadnezzar, which pulled from a lot of different places. The reason why your Ritus Hadoras matters is because it becomes a linchpin for a variety of Hashkafic conversations. So if we're talking about Torah Umada or not, if we're having a conversation, how to relate to it, is it wonderful or is it not so great? So one of the names people will mention early on is, look at the Rambam. Look what the Rambam did. Argues Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was one of the giants in pre-war Europe. He passed away in the Holocaust. Rav Elchanan Wasserman argues, don't use the Rambam at all as a model for Torah Umada. That being an appropriate model to use. Why, says Rav Elchanan? Because there's a concept called Yeridas Hadoros. Generations drop. And even if it was appropriate for the Rambam, so then argues Rav Elchanan, he's not the an interesting Hashkafic figure, argues Rav Elchanan, don't use the Rambam as a model. Yeridas Hadoros impacts and influences a variety of discussions, of Hashkafic discussions. To what extent can we say, can we be innovative? Can we use previous models? If you're a Rabbi Lam Torah Umada person, so the Rambam is the best model you can get. If you're a strong Yeridas Hadoros person, so I'm going to be nervous invoking certain models. You'll have the same thing with certain ideas of Zionism. I should get for the record, I'm a card-carrying modern Orthodox Jew, a believer in Torah Umada, and a Zionist. I just want to use the example to highlight a point. When it comes to Zionism, it appeared somewhat innovative when the Zionist movement started. It appeared somewhat innovative. Obviously, Jews have always loved Eretz Yisrael. It's very hard to open Tanakh and to not get the feeling that Eretz Yisrael is a very chashuv and very prominent place. The notion of going back and that we should have a movement now to get our own country is something which part of the reason why there was some opposition initially is the Yeridas Hadoros opposition. If they couldn't do it, so how can we do it? If they weren't doing this, how is it appropriate for us? And one of the very important theological ideas of Rav Kook in the world of Yeridas Hadoros is Rav Kook argues generations don't always drop. Generations don't always decline. But Rav Kook understands there's always progress. Yeridas Hadoros on a Hashkafic level is not the model, says Rav Kook, to always look at. Because part of what tshuva is for Rav Kook, part of what repentance is, part of what the world is trying to accomplish is to constantly grow and develop in positive ways. So Rav Kook is not so scared of embracing a new movement. Rav Kook is not so terrified of saying, even though it wasn't this way 10 years ago or 100 years ago, doesn't mean that it can't be that way 10 years from now. So Rav Kook is looking at a variety of movements. In the time of Rav Kook, you're looking at socialism, looking at communism. And for some, it's a pure negative. And Rav Kook, there are things built in there. He's not a communist, Rav Kook, although we do have in our history some prominent rabbis who were. Rav Kook is someone who was able to look at a movement and say, what can I derive from here? What can I take from here? Because in the world of Rav Kook, there's a lot of progress. The world is moving in a certain sense. I'll share with you what I think is maybe the most extreme formulation I'm aware of a non-Yeridas Hadoros line. The Biala Rebbe is a prolific author. He lives in Switzerland. As a child, he was born at the beginning of the Holocaust, I believe. He escaped with his sister. They made their way from Europe through Russia. They ended up in Iran. On the way to Iran were a group of secular Zionists who saw this little Hasidish kid and his sister. They picked them up on the way from Iran and brought them to Israel. They get to Israel. and the Panev Vizirah, Yosef Kahaneman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Panevich, sees these secular Zionists and this little kid with the long payas, and he's instrumental in reuniting the Mevaser Tov, the Biala Rebbe, with his father. The son published a lot of Sfarim, including in that a Siddur. It's a Siddur which is a very beautiful Siddur. It's a beautiful commentary. It's very, very nice. And he writes in there that his father did something. He changed it in the Siddur. His father did not have 13 animamins. The Rambam, we know, codified 13 animamins. They're in the back of our Siddur, though not written by the Rambam. We have 13 animamins. And his father added two animamins, two additional points that were not there in the Rambam. Look in source number 19. Mitakanas Maran, Zecher Tzadik, Livracha L'chayom Haba, L'hosif V'lomar, Shnei Animamin Elu. We should have, and in the Siddur it's printed a variety of times. When you finish Shmona Esrei, so have this, make sure to go over the animamins to say all 15 of these. Animamin She Yisrael Heim Am Segulasa. One of the animamins that he included is the belief that the Jewish people are a unique people. That we are an Am HaNivchar. What exactly that means, if you're a rehearsed person, it means that I live a life and a certain mission to give over and to impact the world around me. For others, it means that Jews should feel a certain kind of elevated status. But Am Segula, to feel in a certain sense that we are unique. The second one is wild. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima. I believe with complete faith. Shebechol dor vador. That's not a mainstream source. Just to clarify that again. That's why we're bringing it from the Biala Rebbe, who lives in Switzerland. Not normally where we go for the most classic approaches. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima. Shebechol dor vador is tzadikim ke'Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. I believe with complete faith that in every single generation there are righteous people on the level of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. The Bevaser Tov, the Chakos Yoshua, his father, essentially argues decline of generations, maybe generations as a whole, but they're unique figures with the capacity to be on the same level as the Avos, as Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And not only that, part of emunah, part of belief is in the potential for a high level of spiritual righteousness. I want to review what we spoke about so far so we can set the stage for just part two, which will start at 8:15 and 42 minutes, I think. Yeah. No, we're doing... I'm great. I mean, I hope you are also doing nicely, but... Sorry. So far, we spoke about the concept of Yiras HaDoros, which I have to point out two main approaches. Approach number one argues Yiras HaDoros, decline of generations, is a very powerful idea. It is one that continually impacts. There's a drop, generation, generation, and it gives us a feeling sometimes of being on a bit of a lower level. And if I embrace that approach, especially very strongly, it's possible it will impact how I relate to a variety of hashkafic issues, how innovative I can be, how progressive I can be, because I feel like if they didn't do it, so I'm lower than them, how far can I go? And we tried to highlight a bit of a different model, that there are a variety of sources that indicate that it's not as sweeping as it initially seems. And that there are some sources that indicate for us that as individuals, we could be exceptionally righteous, the Mevaser Tov, the Biala Rebbe, and the ruler of Kook, as a generation, we can be a generation that is located in a very, very different place. The uniqueness of our generation, I want to try to speak about three or four ideas. Some things that make the era in which we live a little bit unique, and hopefully working off different models when you read the Sadoros, some that think our generation's a bit of a lower level and how that impacts things, and some that think our generation's on a bit of a higher level and how that impacts things, and hopefully we can derive some nice ideas from it. Anyone here have any strong Chabad-Lubavitch connections? Okay, wonderful. So in the Sefer Tanya, Tanya is written by the first Lubavitch Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liavi. And the Sefer Tanya is one of the... If you ever learn, one of the strange things about Hasidic texts, this is just interesting to know, the vast majority of Hasidic texts are written on the Parsha, at least a good portion of them. And they're written to the Parsha. Often they're like loosely or very distant from the world of Pshat. There are very few classic Hasidic Sfarim that are written as an independent work. You can just start from the beginning and go through. Not like I'm looking on the Parsha, but a straight work. One of those classic Sfarim is the Sefer Tanya. The Tanya introduces a bit of a Kabbalistic idea. I hope that's okay. I mean, it's definitely okay that he introduced it. I hope it's okay that I will share it with you. And the Tanya, is there, it's a Kabbalah class now. Isn't there? Introduction to Kabbalah. We're not creating golems. Not yet. Second semester. Exactly. Says the Tanya as follows. Every generation corresponds, again, it's a little bit of a Kabbalistic idea, corresponds to a part of the body. The generation, when we talk about receiving the Torah, it's a very high generation, it corresponds to the head, a very, very high level. This generation, in Hasidic and Kabbalistic texts, is referred to as the generation or the time period called the Ikvisa Dimashivcha. When one feels a certain closeness to the world of redemption, we're in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, and one feels a certain sense of redemption, and it's called the footsteps, the heels of Mashiach. And the Sefer HaTanya writes in that generation, whereas the earlier generations were like the head, I don't know what this is, but let's pretend this is something. So this looks like a heel. Is this a heel?
No.
Can we pretend it is? Great. I mean, it's not... We all know what a body looks like. It has a head, and then, you know? It's very good. My brother does a great Fred Flintstone, if you haven't seen it yet. The early generation is like the head, argues the Sefer Tanya, that our generation is a bit of a lower generation. It's all the way like the heels. It's a generation, hopefully, when we're starting to feel a bit of that redemption, of the Jewish people returning to Eretz Israel. But it's a little bit of a low level. For some, that has the following implication. If you look in source number 13, or source number 15 is probably even 14, 15, Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. One of the very wild Hasidic thinkers is Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. The reason why he's very wild is he's not a classic Hasid. He didn't start out as a Hasid. It's a little bit of a sad story. He started out as a non-Hasid. He was married to a girl. There were people in the community that did not like. This is not going to be one of those like pick-me-up stories. I hope that's okay. He was people in the community did not like him that much, and they spread rumors about his wife that she was, let's just say, not the most tanua of all people when it came to her interactions with others. But Tzadok wanted to divorce her because he was a very pious person. Thought it was not. His wife would not receive a get. He decided to go and get a Heter Meir Rabbanim, to go to three different countries, and if 100 rabbis signed something, so then he was able to marry a second woman. A very, very controversial move. He was young at the time. When he went to the Divrei Chaim of Sanz, the Sanz of Rebbe, the Rebbe told him, do not go through with this, and if you do, you will never have children. And Kach Hava, he never had children, he went through with it. On the way, he ended up going to different people. There are some good stories from where he went. And he ended up spending a Shabbos with the Ishbitzer Rebbe, and he became a chassid on the spot. So Tzadok is a fascinating figure because he fused together his non-Hasidic upbringing and early life with his Hasidic transition later on. So he's a bit of a wild and interesting thinker. And if Tzadok writes, generations that are lower are able to affect much more. Generations that correspond to the lower parts of the body are able to have more of an impact. Why, says Reb Tzadok? Because the more challenging it is, when you live at a time where there are a lot of challenges, and for all of us, hopefully there aren't, but if there are ever challenges, argues Reb Tzadok, the more that there are sometimes challenges and we persevere and we're successful, it means more to the Ribono Shel Olam. It means more Klapei Shemaya than anything we could ever imagine. That a person, when everything is always very simple, and we're very, very gifted, and everything is very, very easy, so it's important to be successful and to do a lot. But Sechet Tzadok, when you live in a generation, and for in many ways it's a generation when it's a bit harder. Generation when it's a bit hard to focus sometimes, a lot of things are pulling out in different directions. It's generation when it's easier in a certain sense to assimilate. The generation which is somewhat challenging, Sechet Tzadok, in those generations that are part of Yerida's Hadoros, every mitzvah becomes more valuable. Every piece of Torah that is learned, every chesed that is performed, becomes more valuable, says Reb Tzadok. Learning now is different than learning 200 years ago. It's worth more because each generation, it sometimes becomes a little bit harder. And when it becomes harder and we still try and succeed, that is something in and of itself which is exceptionally powerful. So argues Reb Tzadok. A second idea, as far as this generation, I'm going to shift from that to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I have cups on both sides right now. That's very nice. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was a prolific. Was a major force in a variety of areas. Most of us are probably aware of Lubavitcher Rebbe's impact as far as communal life. Wherever you go, there's a Chabad house. Some of us may be going to university where there's a Chabad house. And he was, as a Jewish communal figure, exceptionally significant. He was also a major scholar. He was a major scholar, and a lot of his works have been published. I guess the value of not having a new Rebbe is that they're also working on his stuff, and they're putting out his stuff, so, you know, he has a monopoly on that in the world of Chabad. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they put out recently his comments on Hilchos Tshuva, on the world of Tshuva. And he has an amazing observation. At my Shabbos table, my oldest son is 8. I have a son who's 8, a daughter who's 6, and I have 2 more sons, one who's 3 and one who's 1, Bli Ayin Hara. I love having the opportunity at my Shabbos table to ask my kids questions. So one of the questions I asked them last week, it's a little bit different than the way I said to them, I think in a more age-appropriate way, was the following. I would say in a much more age-appropriate way. You have a guy. He's convicted of a capital crime. And he is sentenced to death by Beis Din. He runs away and he escapes. Some of you have these stories. Someone who's in America, you have these stories like every, I don't know, year and a half or so. There's some guy who was convicted of a crime or he escaped from prison. They discover him like 45 years later and he's just a nice, sweet guy living somewhere. So 30 years later, the guy's convicted of a crime. So Tshuva asked, convicted of a crime, what would be the halacha? You'd find him 30 years later. And 30 years later, it looks to be a totally different person. Exceptionally righteous. He is sitting down all day in a Beit Midrash. He is sitting there learning with an unbelievable amount of focus. And they find him, and the following question arises. What do we do with the guy? On the one hand, 30 years ago, we found him to be guilty of a crime and deserving of a very harsh punishment. On the other hand, look where he is now. A life filled with repentance. We do the research. It looks like he's totally progressed. He's beyond that right now. Look where he is. Look what he's done. And in Noda B'Yehuda writes, and this is a somewhat troubling idea, he writes, you know what? It doesn't matter what he does right now because Beit Din is limited by what they can know for sure. And Tshuva is between him and God. But we can't know for sure where he's at. So we're stuck. Says Noda B'Yehuda, there are certain crimes that you can't always avoid the punishment. The Lubavitcher Rebbe offers the following insight. Not nowadays. Beis Din doesn't give punishments nowadays. Beis Din doesn't give lashes and doesn't engage in capital punishment. Argue the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in our generation, there is not a sin a person could perform for which they could not do tshuva and avoid that punishment. This generation, despite the lack of certain things, we're not zocha, we don't merit a Beit HaMikdash or a Beit Din that's able to function the way we would love them to be able to function. But this generation, there is nothing a person can do for which there can't be repentance. We spoke so far, Yerida HaDoros in general, our generation, one idea. An idea from Reb Tzadok and the Baal Tanya. If the generations do drop, what that means is everything we do is more valuable. In the Lubavitcher Rebbe's mind, it means that in this generation, there's nothing that we can't do tshuva for. That's one of the reasons why. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, his theology, his learning, impacted the way that he lived his life. One of the reasons why the Lubavitcher Rebbe was so into getting people to come back to Judaism, one of the reasons why he invested so much time in playing up the significance of lighting Shabbos candles, of learning, of coming back to our religion, is because the Rebbe understood that this is a generation where tshuva is all the more powerful. And therefore, we have to make it all the more accessible. We have to make it all the more available, argued the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because in this generation, nothing can stop us from doing tshuva. I want to share with you a third idea from a figure. I told him last week in the yeshiva, he's a wild figure. There is a religious Zionist Kabbalist. His name is the Chalban. Someone translate the word. Who here has heard of the Chalban? Amazing. The Chalban, someone translate. What's a Chalban? Anyone know? Let's go for the show, Resh. I think we're talking Chalban, Chet, Lamed, Bet, is milk. Chalban, he's a milkman. He worked in a factory, I think, that produced cheese. If you look at him, I have a cousin who tweeted that he was going to meet the Chalban, so he got dressed up in like a nice white shirt, and he got just in a suit. He goes to meet the Chalban. Chalban is he's an older guy, I think in his 80s or so. Clean-shaven guy. When you meet the Chalban, his picture of him in the Chalban, where the Chalban's wearing a blue shirt, and he doesn't wear he looks like my grandfather used to look. And he is a person in the Dati Lumi, in the religious Zionist world. He's a Kabbalist. He's part of, I think he's maybe the last living member of a small group. This is wild stuff. If you want to know the difference between modern Orthodoxy in America and Zionism in Israel, if you ever feel that difference a little bit, with Salvation, we spoke about before, was not a Kabbalist, he was not a mystic. So the world, the modern Orthodox world in America, has very little, nowadays neo-Hasidut notwithstanding, has very little of sort of that mystical feel. Rav Kook is a Kabbalist. Rav Kook is a religious Zionist, he's a mystic. Rav Kook's wearing tefillin all day, he's very pious. Not that Salvation was not a pious person. Rav Kook had a certain specific kind of piety. And you have in the religious Zionist world, so he was part of a group of Kabbalists. A wild thing. They were all referred to by their profession. So he was the Chalban. And they've started publishing his Sfarim in the last bunch of years. If you go to different, you'll see it increasingly that the Sfarim are starting to spread a little bit. And he has a beautiful insight about the tshuva of this generation. And it's one, especially in the beginning of the year, it's such a powerful, powerful idea. In the Torah, in Parshas Nitzavim, the Torah describes the mitzvah of tshuva. In its description of the mitzvah of tshuva, the Torah describes how there's kibbutz golios, how around the time that there's tshuva, Jews are all going to come back to Eretz Yisrael. Argues the Chalban, when the Torah spoke about tshuva, it's speaking about, the Torah was speaking about our era, an era of kibbutz golios, an era of different people from all walks of life, different people from different countries who were all coming to Eretz Yisrael. In Yeshivat Shalvin, they changed a couple years ago. When it was started, the Yeshiva Davin Nusach Ashkenaz. Now the policy in Yeshivat Shalvin, as well as the policy in a variety of Hezder institutions, is that the Nusach is determined by whoever gets up to Davin. Because the world has, it's not a halachic analysis right now, but the world has developed, and this world in particular, where you have people coming from all over, and everyone is feeling a certain kind of, that they're welcome and they're included. And those who, it used to be a predominantly Ashkenazi feel, now it's a feel where there's people who are all from different countries and different kinds of davening. And it's something which, in the beginning, can be a little bit frustrating at times. We're used to one nusach. And when you take a step back, it's exceptionally beautiful. Exceptionally beautiful. That Jews are coming together from different places. And the Chalban writes that when the Torah teaches us about tshuva, you know what it's describing? It's talking about our generation. That our generation's generation, which has witnessed, says the Chalban, the return to Eretz Yisrael. And that's a form of tshuva also. Because tshuva is getting closer to Hashem. And the first step, says the Chalban, is when Jews physically return to Israel. When we physically come back. That's the kibbutz golios described. That there are people from all over who come to spend time in Eretz Yisrael. and says the Chalban, you know what, always the physical comes first. That first, there's a physical return to Eretz Yisrael, a physical return to the closeness, being closer to Hashem, being close to a certain world. And says the Chalban, that always is what precedes a spiritual return as well. This is a generation, argues the Chalban, when you want to think about the uniqueness of this generation, don't focus on how it's a lower generation. Don't focus only on how every mitzvah we do now is more valuable, though that's definitely also true. And don't focus only on what the Lubavitcher Rebbe described, how there isn't a sin we can't do tshuva for. Everything we do, we can avoid any punishment. That's the blessing of tshuva in our generation. But says the Chalban, you want our generation? A generation that's turned into progress. A generation where we've actually returned. A generation where we've come back home. And that's a generation when there's a physical return to the land of Eretz Yisrael, we're able to experience real closeness. And that's our generation, argues the Chalban, to try to tap into that. Because that, he argues, is a step right before redemption. The step right before the Geula. The physical return. When we take advantage of the spiritual return, that is what ushers in the ultimate redemption. Let me just review, go over a little what we said, and then we'll end with one point. We spoke tonight about the Cook's insight. Cook says every neshama is brought into this world specifically, and the generation is brought in for. So we understand, what's our generation like? What's our generation? And one approach is to look at our generation in a pretty sweeping way and say things get lower and lower, and things fall a little bit. And even if that's true, argues the Baal Tanya, and argues Tzadok, even if that's true, so it's lower, but it's so much more valuable. It's so much more significant. Every mitzvah that's performed has enormous value. And another model we spoke about is one where it's not that simple, and things aren't always falling. And there is, in a certain sense, a progression. And there are exceptions of individuals who are extremely righteous, or movements, or generations that are uplifting different things. And when that's the orientation that we have, the kind of tshuva we have, argues the Chalban, it's a radically different kind of tshuva. It's a radically different kind of tshuva. Just to end with one brief comment. The Chalban writes that part of the power of this generation is the Jewish people coming together. Is the Jewish people from different places being able to come together. It is such a powerful thing in the month of Elul, and as we shift to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, one of the greatest things a person can do to position themselves well is to feel a sense of connection with the Jewish people. Coming in and hearing my first time ever hearing the Chadashot, coming in and being to encounter people who are engaged and interested in the world outside, the significance of it, and forming and building connections with all the people in this room to cultivate a certain sense of camaraderie and closeness. The tshuva of this generation is a tshuva where all of the Jewish people are getting in on it. All of the Jewish people are returning. There's a certain sense of klal, a certain sense of togetherness, which the Chalban says to tap into, is enormously, enormously powerful. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Have a wonderful night.
Thank Rabbi Zvensky for sharing words of